My name is Grant Vermeer, a member of the Crown Refs community. My first year as a high school official, that's when I found out about the Crown Refs community. Having my military background, I love being a part of teams. I want to be a part of a group that has high standards, that holds each other accountable, but also supports and loves each other, and has a desire for everyone in the group to grow. If you're a young referee or someone who loves refereeing and wants to be a part of a group, this is an amazing community for you. I feel like I've gotten better as an official. I've had a community and friends and support through this process, which can otherwise be a little bit lonely as you're on the road a lot. The culture is amazing in here. Make sure to come check it out.
Serve the game.
To join our community, simply go to patreon.com/crownrefs to choose your tier, or you can schedule a one-to-one call with me directly if you email me at crownrefs@gmail.com. Look forward to hearing from you.
It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year.
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations. Forgotten. The history.
Vegas Golden Knights.
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Thank you for listening to the Crown Refs Podcast, the audio experience for basketball officials. Serve the game.
Big Sean, what's going on?
Having fun. Got to hang out with Ben a couple nights ago. That was good times.
I saw that. I appreciate you posting. Glad you guys got to work together.
And I updated my Patreon shirt size, so I should
be nice. Shirt
now.
Okay, cool. So you got the confirmation email that it's coming?
The next cycle will hit.
I appreciate it. Welcome back to the Crown Refs Podcast. We are excited to have Randy McCall with us, a veteran NCAA basketball men's official and esteemed athletic administrator. Randy brings over 40 years of experience across high school and collegiate athletics. He's not just a respected figure in the world of officiating. Randy also has served as the director of athletics at Cherry Creek High School in Colorado, where he successfully led 25 athletic programs and was instrumental in achieving 67 state championships. Is that a world record? We're gonna click down on that in a minute and let you touch on that. In officiating, Randy has an impressive resume, having officiated in Division I basketball since 1992, including multiple NCAA tournaments and six Final Fours. His dedication to excellence was recognized when he was named the 2014 Naismith Men's College Official of the Year. Off the court, he's a devoted family man, deeply invested in his community. He's also a former coach and teacher, having taught U.S. history, world geography. He also holds a master's in athletic administration from Idaho State University and a bachelor's in history from the University of Northern Colorado, where he was also a celebrated student athlete. Welcome to the Crown Refs Podcast, Mr. McCall. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Appreciate being here. It's nice to be a part of this. I don't know if I've ever been, I haven't been called Mr. in a long time, so that kind of threw me off a little bit, but it's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate your time and excited to get to know you a little bit more. Randy, you've had a distinguished career as both an NCAA basketball official and an athletic administrator. Can you first share with us how you got involved in officiating and what drew you to this path?
Well, in high school, I was, you know, back in the 1970s, if they even had high school then. But I played three sports, and my father was the athletic director, deeply invested in athletics. He was a high school American football player, so I've got a family background that is very entrenched in competitive athletics, and my father officiated some. I went to Northern Colorado, played my first year, and then in the spring I had an injury and wasn't able to play my sophomore year. So I decided, rather than sit around, drink beer and get fat, I decided I'd try to do something a little bit more constructive. And I took a class in sports officiating, basketball, and took the test. They were in need of officials. So I started refereeing games and really didn't know what the heck I was doing, to be honest with you. Just ran around and tried to do the best I could.
This episode of the Crown Refs podcast is brought to you by RefereeStore.com. To save 15% on all United Attire products, enter Crown15 at checkout. We hope you enjoy this episode, and do us one last favor before you listen. Have a great rest of your day.
But that's how I got involved in athletics and specifically in officiating. Since that point, I've coached football and basketball at the high school level. I spent a couple of years at Idaho State University as a graduate assistant. Was fortunate to be around a number of people that were really, really qualified. Was able to kind of get my feet on the ground, and I took all of those experiences and put them all together. And during the first few years, when I really didn't have a great idea what I was doing refereeing, I simply tried to apply all those things that I learned as a player, all those things I learned as a coach, to be involved and make my part of the game, a collaboration of all of those things. And I still, to this day, I think back on coaching philosophies and ideas. I think back on playing and what kids are trying to accomplish. I kind of pride myself on staying updated with all of those things, and not just necessarily just the officiating piece. It's an important part, obviously, but I really try to look at it from a coach's point of view, from a player's point of view. And lo and behold, I have a couple of kids and they participated in athletics. And my daughter's still a lacrosse player. We get to go watch her play tonight. So, that's all exciting. And then it's really neat to see a community get involved and be supportive of those types of programs. Those still are really good things. They're really positive things. I think, it teaches kids a lot more than what we did, having them sit in a math class or a science class or a social studies class. They learn how to work together. They learn how to be leaders. They learn how to collaborate. They learn how to be led. Sometimes that's a real difficult one. It's kind of, at my point now, it's kind of satisfying to look back and think of all those kids that we had an impact on. And even through officiating, I think of some of the guys I refereed, and of course I was blessed to be able to do that, but at the same time, I hope that I left something a little bit lasting for them as well. I've been very fortunate, been very, very fortunate. You mentioned all those things that I've been able to do, had a lot of help and had a lot of things go my way. And like I said, I'm just very, very fortunate that I was able to experience all of those things.
Thank you for that. Let's fast forward a little bit. You've officiated some high stakes environments, including multiple Final Fours, national championships. Can you describe what it's like to officiate at such a high level and how you prepare mentally and physically for these events?
I always go back to the first Final Four that I worked. It was in 2004. I have some ideas how I advanced to that at that point, but that was only my fourth NCAA tournament. And I'm working the last night of the tournament. Don't know how that works, but I was excited to go work. I didn't realize what I was about to walk into, though. That was back in the day where they play. They obviously play the Final Four in the big stadiums, the big dome stadiums. And today they configure it so they have 75,000-80,000 people in the building. 2004, they kind of tucked it up into one side and they had about 45,000 people. Well, when you're kind of used to, maybe working at best in front of 18, 20,000 people, and you walk out there and there's 48, 50,000 people, you look around, and I can remember walking out there and thinking to myself, number one, it took forever to get from the locker room out to the court. And then once we got out there, I looked around and I thought to myself, oh my God, look at all these people. And I just took a moment to kind of take it all in. And then I started watching the guys warm up and I looked at them and the next time you go to a college game, I want you to look at the faces of those kids because they're kids. I mean, you look at their faces and it's just a kid and they got a basketball just like I had when I was playing, and they're just playing a game, and it's inside the same confines that we all played in. It's a basketball game. It's kids playing basketball. And that was the one thing that struck me after I looked around and kind of took in the moment, I guess. I looked at the kids warming up and I thought, you know what? It's just a group of guys playing basketball. I've been doing this for however long it is. And, you know, it's another game and I'm going to go treat it like another game. And it kind of was interesting how I kind of was able to calm myself down. And, you know, I refereed pretty well. I know that the powers that be thought we were pretty good that night. But it, you know, every moment, there's different moments that happen. And I think everyone that's on this, you know, this podcast will look at it and think, you know, there's a step forward. There's a moment in my career that I feel like I'm advancing, and it feels like it's really big. And what I would encourage people to do is just take a look at who's out there. It's just players. There's players, there's two baskets on both ends of the floor. It's 5-on-5. Just go do your thing. You know, it's no different than playing. Sometimes people got to play in big games. Well, just go do your thing. And that's the one thing I remember about the first Final Four I worked. You know, there are bits and pieces of different tournament experiences and all kinds of experiences that I collect and kind of reflect on. But that was the one thing that I recall from my first Final Four. It's just a game. It's 5-on-5. They got a basketball. Let's just go play and I'll do my job.
I think a lot of officials who've been asked that question kind of describe it the same way as you did, where maybe a little nervous as the pregame and leading up to it, but there's a point that happens where you just say it's just another game like everything else. That's kind of what you're describing.
Yeah. I think most of the guys, if I were to, you know, talk to the guys that I work with that have had that experience, I think they would describe something like you said, something very similar to what I have. I can remember, you know, the anticipation of getting out there where all of a sudden you see the floor. It took a little while to walk there. And once we got out there, and then you see the crowd and you go, oh my God, look at all these people, you know, and you feel a little bit, I don't know what the exact term would be, but you're almost paralyzed for a moment. And then, like I said, I looked at the kids, and man, they're just baby faced kids. They're 20-year-old kids, 19-year-old kids. And it's a basketball game. I've been doing it a long time. I'm just going to go referee. And I think people, I would imagine most of the guys that we would talk with would have that kind of experience.
So, Randy, I was writing down a couple questions last night, and then I was going through my Instagram feed right after, and I said, you know what? I'm going to actually ask questions and pull topics right from my feed, because a lot of the videos I make, I like to put a title on it. So okay. I think there's a lot of great little micro topics that we could touch on. So mm-hmm. I would love to kind of tell you what each post is about real quickly and then kind of let you build on it and hear your thoughts. How's that sound?
Sounds great.
So posted this yesterday about a partnering tip. You know, these are Can you guys hear the audio? Do you guys hear that audio or no?
No.
Yeah, I get it. I got
a little light.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, I think we miss it. Anyway, this gentleman calls a foul. The trail official switches over, and it's their first time working together. And the trail official just says, you know, great call, baby. And I just thought that was a great way to kind of uplift your partner, especially if you haven't, you know, worked with him yet. And it's happened to me before where I felt, you know, very inspired and kind of reassured that the call on the court was right at the time, or at least I thought so. So what's your thoughts on just great partnering and kind of building, you know, those long-term relationships?
I think the example you give is a real positive example of how we contribute to our success. One of the things that you find in our profession is you find those people that work together, that want to get the game right. That's their goal. And then you find those few people that are there for one person, and that's to protect themselves. That kind of, you know, the example you gave is team building is basically what you're doing. And the other side of that I think you can also add, especially if you're, let's say you're the veteran on the crew and everyone kind of, you know, they know who you are and what your background is and what your experience has been. And let's say that it's their first time with you. All of us make mistakes, you know, that's just the bottom line. Best referees in the country make mistakes. That's just the reality of it. So sometimes when we have a mistake that's made, how many officials have you guys been with where they'll never admit that they screwed something up? You know, I mean, there's a lot of guys that do that. Fortunately, there's a lot more people that are in our profession that when they kick one, first person to acknowledge that they kicked the call is the person that did it, the referee that did it. So, you know, when you can, you know, be supportive on a young referee making a proper call, or at least what, like you said, Paula, a call that you believe is the correct call and an important call, a call we need to get. Well, we can turn that around and also acknowledge mistakes that we make, because what that does, it frees up the young guy on the crew to not concern himself when there's a mistake made, because the guy's going to make a mistake. When he screws something up, you've already said, God dang, I can't believe I put a whistle on that play. That's awful. You know, say something like that. You're going to get that young guy to bounce back a little bit quicker when he makes a mistake, just by acknowledging that, you know, you also can tend to screw things up. You know, someone told me you have to be able to show courage as an official. And the second thing you have to be able to do is you have to admit mistakes, because that's the reality of it. It's a human experience. But I think, you know, what the example that you gave, you know, that's great to do, because it's team building. And the better we are as a team, the better we're going to be that night. And of course, that should be the goal that we have. You know, let's walk out of here thinking, you know what, we gave everyone a fair shot. I can guarantee you that if you feel like you've had a negative impact on the outcome of a game and you walk off the floor with that feeling, man, it doesn't go away. And I've done it. Shoot, you know, and it doesn't go away. And to be honest with you, those are my, you know, most vivid memories is when I screw something up and it maybe has an impact on the outcome. You know, you don't like to do that. So the only way that you can kind of stay away from that misery is to collectively have a good night. So
thank you for that. And to even take that accountability approach one step further, you know, when you succeed, give the crew the credit. Mm-hmm. And when the crew makes a mistake, you take the ownership and accountability. Mm-hmm. Let's get into dead ball officiating. Here's a clip, a loose ball play. Two players go to the ground and they got up with no issues, and they, you know, they helped each other up. So the official was thanking them and saying, "We're good, we're good." What are some— now, this was an example of a nice scenario, but let's talk about maybe when tensions rise a little bit and opponents are kind of going at each other. What's some tangible advice you have for dead ball officiating, and what does your dead ball officiating sound like?
Well, I think people have to have, you know, a really good referee, a referee that kind of controls a game, needs to have a presence of some kind, you know. In other words, there are some guys that I've worked with that, you know, were big dudes, man. They were 6'3", 6'4", athletic looking. You know, they were kind of imposing when they walked on the floor. Well, that's kind of not me, you know. I walk out there, I'm 5'9", and, you know, got gray hair, and there's nothing about me that looks really imposing. But the one thing I was blessed with was a coach's voice. I had a voice that kind of pierces through everything. When I go watch my daughter play, you know, every now and then something will come out of my mouth that probably shouldn't. And my wife will look at me like, "Stop." And I'm thinking to myself, well, I just kind of said it to us. She goes, "Your voice cuts through everything." And that's my presence. My presence is my voice. And the one thing that we need to make sure that we establish a presence. And I'm not talking about, you know, we're going to take over the game and I'm going to be the show out here. What I'm talking about is I need to somehow make sure those players know that I'm with them every step of the game. Okay. So when I have a foul call, it's a whistle with a fist and then my voice. And it's, you know, like, you know, like 15, that's yours. You know, hold, whatever it is, block, whatever it may be. And the reason I do that is because I want them to grow accustomed to that voice and know that that voice is there. Because that voice being there the whole night is an indication that I'm there the whole night, if that makes sense. Okay. And the only time that if the only time that we decide we have to have a presence is when we have a dead ball situation that goes south on us, you know, a couple kids get crossways with each other or tangled up or whatever it may be, we're going to have a difficult time really managing that if we haven't already established a little bit of presence. Okay. So we have to be able to establish relationships with the players. We have to let them know that we're going to be there the whole game. So when we do have something go a little bit south, the first thing that's going to come out there is my voice. And in most cases, you know, at least with the players I work, they know me. They know who I am, what I stand for, what I allow, what I don't. They immediately will find out, okay, he's there. It's almost like mom and dad. If you remember when you were a kid and you were screwing around, you're doing something you probably shouldn't be doing, and dad's voice all of a sudden jumped in. "Hey, what are you doing?" All of a sudden, what did you do? "Oh God, you just stopped," right? That's it. Okay, done. Same kind of thing here. You know, I want my voice to be there. I want them to recognize that voice, and I want them to understand that I'm dad coming in the room. Knock it off. We're done with that. And then we can start refereeing that way with your voice. I'm a big believer in a voice, everyone. I think that's an intangible that most people don't take advantage of. You know, big guys on the floor. Easy, right there. Get your arm off. Let him go. You know, just little things like that. Coaching them through stuff saves you putting air in your whistle and shooting too many free throws on a given night. And I'm not saying that you just let guys get away with whatever they want to, but establishing your presence, I use my voice, establishing your presence before anything happens, just from the start, just having your voice there, just so they know who you are. Sometimes it's positive. You know, sometimes you look at both the big guys, nice job, keep it right there for me. Okay. They kind of look at each other and all of a sudden, you know, it's okay, we're doing the right thing. We're playing the right way. And they keep playing for you. So to get back to your, you know, how my dead ball officiating starts from the time I walk on the floor, you know, to the time I leave. Because when I walk on the floor, I'm going to start trying to talk. Hey, man, how you doing? Ready to go tonight? Hey, good luck, man. Play great. Just little things like that where I have conversations with kids, because all of a sudden now I've developed a little bit of a relationship with them. And like I said, I'm starting to develop my presence in terms of my job and my role in that game. It starts from the moment you walk out there. And then the next time you referee this team, it's a little bit easier because they have you back again. And then after 4 years in college, after 4 years, there are guys that will walk on the floor and come over and give me a hug because, you know, they're glad to see me. In the last game, they got beat in a tough game. You know, it's a people business. And the better we can work with people in a really competitive environment, the better off we're going to be. So dead ball officiating starts from the moment you walk on the floor. Start developing those relationships. Start being a part of that game, you know, and don't finish to the end, you know, and just stay right with it, with whatever is your presence. That's what you need to establish as soon as you walk on the floor.
Great stuff. So having that parent-like, authoritative father figure voice.
Yeah. Coach's voice. That's, you know, you listen to most coaches, man, I tell you what, when they say something, kids' heads snap around. They turn and look. When Mick Cronin says something, those dudes turn and look, you know. And we got to have the same thing. We've got to be able to command a little bit of a presence as well. The best referees that I work with, they're unbelievable about how they've developed a presence and how they use that to better the game.
As we scroll through this timeline, oh, look at you. You got your picture up there. Looking good.
You know what? That you guys were hitting a home run until you got to that, man. See, like I said, you look at that. There's no presence there. You got an old man, you know. Good thing I've got a coach's voice.
So I want to talk to you next about live ball versus dead ball communication. This is a clip where I thought the official, you know, we don't want to get into conversations during a live ball and definitely not lose focus on the play.
Right.
Sometimes it's unavoidable. Sometimes we need to give a short response. So what does your live ball communication with coaches sound like when they're, you know, requiring you give them an answer, or you need to send them a message about getting to the next play, or I'll be over, you know, at the next timeout?
Yeah. So we're talking about communicating with coaches now.
Specifically though, during a live ball right now, and then we'll get to the dead ball.
Yeah. It depends on your age and stage. It depends on how much, you know, what my relationship is with that coach. You know, if there's a relationship that I have with him that I can tell him, you know, you're so full of whatever, you know, then that's what I say. There might be some coaches where the best thing you can do with them, and all this comes with experience, but the best thing you can do with them is to keep running up and down the floor. Just keep refereeing, you know, because a lot of coaches, well, I shouldn't say a lot, there's a number of coaches that when they talk, they're just, they really don't want an answer. They're trying to misdirect what you do in your role. And that's not even worth, there's nothing really to talk about. There's no question in there, you know, saying, hey, if they're talking, oh, that's 3 seconds. That's a handshake. That's, you know, he's over the back. Oh, he hit him on the arm. You know, that's really, there's nothing really to answer. There's no question. If they truly have a question and you have a moment, and typically it's not during live ball, you're right. I think that's probably the worst time to answer a question, but the best thing to do in most cases is to just keep running up and down the floor and keep refereeing. Just keep refereeing. And sometimes what will end up happening is they'll forget what they were talking about. They forget the play, or they forget, you know, what their statement was in the first place. And you keep moving on, and then all of a sudden you catch them off guard. You know, the ball's out of bounds, and you know he's on to coaching because he's over coaching his kids. You know, you maybe kind of almost interrupt him and say, hey, coach, you had a question. What was it? And most times he'll look at you like, what the hell? Nothing. I'm good. Okay. So you're done. So you've managed it, you know, and you haven't really had to say much of anything. We're not going to out-talk coaches. We're just not going to do it. You think about it, you know, okay, let's take John Calipari. What has he done this past 2 or 3 weeks? He's been on television. He's been in front of boosters. He's been in front of his kids. He's been in living rooms trying to recruit kids. Okay. He talks for a living. He's a public speaker. That's what he does. That's his job. That's not our job. Okay. We're not going to out-talk them. So keep that in mind. If you do have to say something, make it short, make it factual, and then move on. And again, like I said, I think the best thing to do when they are just talking is to just keep running up and down the sideline. Because the more you ignore them, the less they're going to talk. The more you listen to what they say and acknowledge what they say, you're encouraging them. Okay. That makes sense. Beyond that, I think, you know, if you have to respond to something, you know, just something short. Oh, okay. I hear you, coach. Yeah. Yeah. It's a good point, coach. You know, just shake your head, acknowledge. I hear you, you know, I hear you. Just that sometimes is the magic phrase, because all they want to know is if you're listening, and you just kind of shake your head at them or give them a, I hear you. All right. Gotcha. You know, and then keep running. Like I said, keep working. Don't make the conversation something that gets in the way of them having to coach and you having to referee and the players having to play. Everyone's different at this. Everyone's, you know, we're all different in terms of how we deal with coaches. And every coach is a little bit different too. So keep in mind, you have to be true to yourself. You have to do what you think's right. You have to do what you're comfortable with. And what you're comfortable with may be completely different than what I'm comfortable with, you know, but acknowledge one thing for sure. Every coach is different. So most nights, you know, if you're going to hit a home run with them, you know, you're going to have to also be a little bit different every night. Not fair to us, but that's the reality of it.
Carmela had a question about, have you ever had a situation where your voice was not as effective? What'd you do there?
Yeah. Yeah. Because they really didn't want to hear me talk. They wanted something different. And I can't think of, you know, anything, any particular experience that just went completely south because of my voice. I couldn't blame it on me just trying to use my voice. But you have to be careful what you say, you know, because you don't want to be, quote unquote, coaching a kid. You know, that coach won't want you to do it. Why are you coaching that kid and not coaching my kid? That kind of thing. But if you talk to them collectively, you're probably better off. You know, I can't say that it always works. There's nothing that I could tell you that is foolproof. Every bit of it is simply trying to work with people. You know, we've got to be good referees. We got to be good play callers. We got to, you know, understand the game, understand what the powers that be want from us in a game. But the fact of the matter is, realistically, the really good ones are people that understand this is a people management business. It's managing emotional kids. It's managing emotional adults. And it's also controlling yourself, you know, managing your own emotions. How many of us have been in a game where, man, that dude has just pissed me off? Well, I'm not a very good referee when I'm angry. Not at all. Okay, so how do I manage that? Okay, how do I manage a guy that is starting to creep under my skin? Or he is starting to become having a negative effect on the game itself, on what happens between the lines. You know, how do I manage that? So I'm a really big believer in managing people. And if my voice isn't doing it, then I've got to figure out something else. And sometimes best thing I can do is just shut up, you know. And I'm that's the one thing after 40 some years of refereeing that I have a pretty good pulse on. I understand when it's time to say something and when it's time to shut up and just keep running up and down the floor and refereeing, because I am a believer in that. Our job isn't to talk to them. It's not to babysit them. Okay. It's to work with them. But our number one job is to get plays right. Get up and down the floor, take care of the 10 guys in between the lines. That's a good question, Carmel. I don't know if I even answered it.
Tyler Gann came in and said, you can't misquote silence.
Yeah. Great, great, great quote. Yeah, you're right. Absolutely right. And don't forget that. Okay. Sometimes we forget really, really common sense things, you know, like we talked about, you know, show courage, but admit mistakes. Pretty simple. You know, it's perfect. Good one.
I recently had the opportunity to work with a gentleman named Willie Modeste from New York City area. He's been refereeing over 50 years, and I asked him what his why was, and he gave a great answer about just being dedicated to the kids and student athletes, and he's a lifelong teacher and professor. So I know you just mentioned you've been working over 40 years. In order to do that, you must be really in love with it, and not just do it for the money and other reasons. So I ask you, what is your why?
You know, that's a question that I'm going to have to sit here and think about, you know, exactly. When I think about why I enjoy officiating, I grew up in a competitive family. My brother spent 42 years coaching college football, you know, all levels. I mean, well, for the most part, he ended up, you know, played in bowl games. I'm just all that. So that's kind of what he and I were brought up with. And when he was a high school coach, I used to coach against him, and I beat his ass all the time too. You can tell him that. But there's a competitive streak in me, and there's a great feeling about being involved in a competitive environment. And I think if you ask me, you know, what's my why, I think that would be one of them. I think there's there's a competitive nature to what we do. And it's not competitive between us. It's competitive, almost competitive with yourself. You know, making sure that, you know, it's difficult what we do. To have a really good night and do that night after night after night after night is a great challenge. And it's also satisfying. So I think the competitive nature of it is one thing that I would point to. The other part is being around other people that are like-minded, that are in turn competitive themselves, because, you know, every coach we referee on any given night, their goal is the same. It's to win a game. And the players are the same kind of thing. You know, so I'm surrounded by competitive people in a competitive environment. And it's, I think that's what I get the most satisfaction from. Of course, if I think about it a little bit longer, Paul, I might come up with a couple of other things too, but that's the one that jumps out, you know, for me. Yeah.
Yeah. Appreciate that. All right, moving forward, this is a play calling strategy regarding block shot plays. You know, you might have heard the ball before body, body before ball, and this is an absolute. This is not 100% written in the rule book, but just something to take as a guide on those tough plays at the rim. You know, if the defender hits the ball before the body, most times it's a play on, most times. If the defender hits the body before ball, then I would say the percentages would skew more towards a foul. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on this concept and just, you know, refereeing block shot plays, especially with the players that you officiate?
Well, the one thing about that that's happened over the past probably decade, it probably didn't happen when I first was refereeing, but big guys on the inside play really for the most part, they play really vertical. Okay. So if a guy's going to challenge a shot, a big guy's going to challenge a shot at the rim, chances are he's going to get in a position where he's going to be able to, and, you know, we always talk about playing off 2 feet is a heck of a lot more legal than not. And if a guy gets in a position where he's able to play off 2 feet and go straight up, really the play is at the point of contact, which is, you know, up around at the hand. Is it here or is it here? Okay. If they get it here, you know, his verticality kind of absolves himself from everything else. And I think one of the things that's also happened recently in our game is what people try to do, what kids try to do to take away the advantage that a bigger kid might have near the rim is they create contact. They create the force just to kind of eat up the space of the big guy and then be able to get their shot off. You know, I think we have to referee point of contact. If we get caught up with everything else, I think we end up, you know, putting whistles on plays that, you know, if we look back on it, we'll go, nah, I don't really like that, you know. So my feeling is we're refereeing the defense. I've gotten myself in a good position to see this play. Now what I have to referee is point of contact. And point of contact is here. Okay. Is it here? Is it here? You know, what might it be? Okay. And that's kind of what I think is the best way to referee that play. Obviously, find a sweet spot to see through the play. Referee the defender. Referee point of contact. That's what I would give people a little bit of advice on that play.
Brenda Hilton has a company called Officially Human, which is all about restoring sportsmanship and respect for officials. They recently put out this ad talking about the national shortage due to physical and verbal abuse. you have a very wide perspective being on all sides of the game, from officiating, coaching, administratively. I think schools, organizations, administrators, athletic directors have a real opportunity to improve the overall culture of sportsmanship. So I'd like to hear your perspective on that and maybe some of the things that you did to create that positive environment in your schools, and also what you kind of told your coaches on how to treat officials.
You know, I haven't been involved in administrative, you know, as an administrator for 12 years now, 13 years, something like that. And when I was the athletic director, I also spent time serving on committees for the state association. And I spent most of my time doing it with officiating groups. And really, the focus that we had was on taking care of, you know, how we went and tried to recruit officials. At our school, we would have at the end of a season, there would be, I would have the coaches give to me two or three names that they think would be, you know, let's say he's the point guard or on guard on our basketball team, and he's not going to go play anywhere. He might go play intramural somewhere, but that's about it. But he knows how to play. The kid was a really good point guard. So he, you know, he knows where the ball needs to be. He knows when it needs to be there. He knows how to include people. He has an understanding of the game. And I wanted those types of kids that and have them sent to meet with me and give them the opportunity to go referee and referee young kids, you know, elementary age kids. We had a little bit of success with it. We, you know, the elementary school parents, for the most part, they're easily directed. For the most part, there are typically some, and I wouldn't say just dads, but there are some that get sideways. But we were able to hook a few people by refereeing those young kids. We were able to hook a few young people into refereeing, and they've kind of moved on. I know our school district, for the most part, really encouraged people to referee, you know, well beyond even the high schools. We had, you know, NFL referees that were part of the staff in our school district. We had a couple of other Division I basketball referees that were part of our school district. So I think that our district did a nice job of demonstrating a value for the officiating profession. I think that the most important thing that we need to do is we need to make sure that the adults that are working with our kids understand what their role is. And by that, I mean, we want them to be competitive, because I don't care what anyone says, you're going to have to compete for things the rest of your life. But we want them to be competitive in the right manner. Okay. And we need to put quality adults in front of people. Sometimes that doesn't happen. And I'm sure that if I were to look back on the people that I had in coaching positions, I would almost guarantee you that there's probably one or two that I would go, you know, that probably wasn't the right person to put in front of those kids. Where I think it becomes really difficult is when we get into the club situation, because there's no educational value that goes into the club mentality. So when we have, you know, well, and think of how important the clubs really are. Let's look at basketball, just our sport here. You know, The high schools play from, well, let's say the, I don't know, end of November, middle of November till, you know, the first of March, first week or so, maybe second week in March kind of thing. Okay. That's where the high schools have control. Kids are playing year round. Okay. Who are they playing for outside of those, that confines of the educational athletics? They're playing for other people that don't have, they're not held to the same standard that people are during the official basketball season. And when I go to officiating camps during the summer, and I see some of those people who's coaching some of these kids and the way they're acting, not necessarily just towards officials, but towards kids, and maybe even also for towards officials, it becomes an issue. And I think the fact that our sport has grown so much that it's a 12-month out of the year sport makes it really difficult to hold people accountable to the same standard. And we have to look beyond what the schools can do, because I had nothing to do with, for example, in my situation, I had nothing to do with the basketball programs that occurred outside of the school, you know, the school time period. And because of that, I didn't know who was, you know, who the people were, who the adults were, and what they stood for and how they responded to things. It's a really difficult question, because it includes a hell of a lot more people than what we fully acknowledge. Clubs can kind of make up their own rules. And if we have people that make up that are running the clubs that do so with, you know, a great deal of professionalism and, you know, handling themselves in a proper manner, it really helps. And I know that that's what some of the club leagues are trying to work on, but I don't know if they've gotten a full handle on it. I didn't offer anything that we can do. I mean, it's a difficult topic. It really is. And you know, shoot, I go watch my daughter play lacrosse. Typically, that's a three official game. The huge majority of their games are played with two officials. And you know, that's just because they don't have any availability. They don't have people that are there to available to referee. I think, you know, that would be a great open session, open forum for people that are on this link to even talk about, you know, and it'd be interesting to hear what kind of ideas they have.
I did a girls lacrosse game yesterday by myself.
Did you?
Yes, but I selfishly wasn't upset because I got fee and a half and I got a late fee.
Helps. That helps. But still, okay. Did you feel, okay, Paul, it's a really interesting topic. Okay. How did you feel you worked the game? Did you feel really comfortable with it?
Oh, no, you can never feel really comfortable working by yourself. However, it was a low-level modified game. Yeah. And but, no, plenty of times I'm not in position. I don't have an open look. Ball probably went out of bounds one or two times, and I can only cover, you know, my sideline.
Right.
But, yeah, like you said, it's a very big topic. There's a lot of moving parts. But I appreciate you sharing that. Kevin, let's see, chimed in. So as officials, we should hold them accountable for their actions, regardless if it's school ball or AAU ball. I know we always get the saying, this isn't school ball, let them play or whatever, but we ought to officiate the same way, regardless, right or wrong.
I agree. You got to referee the same. It's kind of double-edged, Kevin. You bring up a good point, because if you handle a situation, let's say that you've got the coach that's just being an idiot and you whack him, okay? All right. Well, if he stops there, if he, you know, understands the consequence, then you're fine. If he decides to just continue to go goofy and you throw him out, you pitch him, now you might end up having to be accountable to, you know, the people that run that league. Because let's say this guy is the, I don't know, the John Wooden of basketball in your city. You know, it's difficult to say, you know, what you should do, because you got to know the lay of the landscape. You know, when you're in Rome, do what the Romans do, you know, kind of thing. And I don't know. That's a really good point. I can tell you this. There's a couple of club guys, the supervisors, the people that run. There's a group called Gold Crown in our city that does a whole lot. Every week they have competitive games and competitive tournaments and stuff like that. And I know those people, and I know that they want this to be a credible resource for kids. So when officials go in there, they should expect coaches to adhere to the standard of the game, not to the standard of the club game or the standard of the high school game or the standard of, you know, whatever standard is, the overall standard of the game of basketball in their rule. That's what they expect. They expect to have technical fouls, and they expect sometimes that they're going to have to remove coaches. Okay, so we've got a group in this city that is fully on board with us trying to make this better for kids. But I don't know if that's true in every other situation. So you bring up a good point.
Let's get to a lighter topic, rotations in the lead. A lot of officials that go from 2 to 3 person, you know, one of their biggest question marks is when to rotate in the lead. This specific clip is about missing rotations when maybe the center doesn't realize that the lead has rotated over, or the trail doesn't realize the lead is rotated over and they're becoming the new center. A lot of times that happens due to rushed rotations or the lead running over instead of walking briskly. What's your philosophy on rotations? And for the officials listening that are just starting their three person, what advice do you have for them?
I think that there's a whole lot of things that are being taught throughout the country and in different consortiums throughout college basketball. And of course, you know, I think a lot of people take what happens in the college game because they see it on television and they watch how guys referee, you know, in big games on television. And in some cases, there's been a kind of an assimilation to what the NBA does. Well, the NBA has a 24-second clock. That's a pretty quick possession. Chances of you know, having to rotate and on every possession and, you know, having a situation where we need to have the lead official rotate kind of is reduced. Okay. Some people teach leads to referee wider, which again reduces the amount of times that we're going to be able to rotate. My feeling on it is pretty simple. If we have competitive post action on the opposite side of the floor, on the opposite side of the floor from the lead official, I think the lead official should be there. Because anyone that's refereed post action from the center understands that it's pretty damn difficult to referee that. Okay, at least from that spot. It becomes even more difficult to referee that play if you have a competitive matchup with the ball out in front of you in the center spot and also have a competitive matchup in the post. Okay. I hope I'm describing that well enough for people to get a visual on it. If we've got a competitive post matchup and a competitive matchup outside with the ball, I think the lead needs to rotate, period. And, you know, Paul, sometimes I think guys have to pick up the pace and take a couple of quick steps to get going, to get over there, to referee the play. Because the last thing we want to do is have the post action all of a sudden become a post move with us standing in the middle of the lane, because we're not able to referee at all from there. I'm a believer in getting to the ball side, especially when we have post action on the ball side. Okay. And it's a kind of a feel thing. It's an understanding of what kind of offense they run. It's an understanding of the players, the personnel that we have on the floor. Okay. It's an understanding of all of those things, because sometimes there's no reason in the world to rotate over there, because you know what? They're not going to throw it into the dude. He's not an offensive player. He's not a guy that they're going to get a whole lot of offense out of. Okay. So there's no real reason, no urgency to get over there. Okay, but if you got Akeem Olajuwon down there, okay, you better get your ass over there. That's all there is to it. You know, so there's a whole lot of things that I think you need to consider, and it changes from night after night. But if I were to say, this is kind of what I believe in, if the ball is on the opposite side from the lead official, and we have a competitive post matchup on that side, or on the opposite side from the lead should be over there. Okay. I don't know if that helps, but it's kind of where I stand on. I think I'm probably a little bit more of the belief that there's no reason in the world for us not to be able to rotate maybe once a possession, you know. But I don't know. There's going to be people that disagree, and you know what? They're going to have good points. And yeah. You know, we can go back and forth forever, but that's kind of what I believe.
Thank you. Appreciate you sharing that. This post is about one of the biggest mistakes we make when putting whistles on incidental contact is just being reactionary to contact, maybe offensive initiated contact or vertical defenders. What would you say about just being 100% when you're blowing the whistle and just play calling, your play calling beliefs as far as discerning between incidental and illegal? And well, avoiding, you know, being reactionary.
Yeah. You don't want to, I kind of make fun of it as, you know, we're kind of like the dog that's in the backyard, then all of a sudden, squirrel. Oh God, you know, we jump at stuff, you know, when anything happens, and it's just, you know, just calm down, let the play happen. I think one thing that I was taught a long time ago, that we wanted to see the outcome of the play before we put a whistle on a play, especially when we get around the basket. What's the outcome? Okay. Is the outcome a missed layup? Okay. Well, what caused him to miss the layup? Is there illegal contact? Well, we can maybe pass on illegal contact if the ball goes in. Everyone understands that. Okay. But if there's illegal contact and the ball doesn't go in, you know, and let's say it's minor contact. We've had a pretty good game and they've done a pretty good job of playing through contact, and all of a sudden we have something that's a little bit of contact, but it really is the causal factor of that shot being missed. We need to have a whistle on that play. Then we have a delayed whistle. You know what? You get people that you used to get people that would say, "Oh, that's a little late whistle," you know, but whatever. Okay, they don't say that anymore. What they say is that's a really good whistle, you know, and coaches are even saying that that's a good whistle, because we refereed not only what took place on the play, but also the outcome of the play. How many times do we let a guy dribble through contact because we anticipate that guy has an opportunity to play through that successfully and then be in an advantageous position to make a play on the offensive end, possibly score. We do that quite a bit. Okay. Well, I think we need to do that again at plays to the basket. And again, I think if you start setting in your mind, I want a referee outcome. If you can't always do that, because some games, I don't care. All the philosophies go out the door because they're just not playing. And you know what? It's foul. That's a foul. Because we need to do that, or these guys are just going to, you know, it's going to turn into a fist fight. But if we've got a basketball game where they're competing and playing well, think about outcome. Try to referee outcome more than just contact itself. And some plays you can't really do that, but plays to the basket and the plays that, Paul, you were talking about, you know, block shot type plays, I think you can referee outcome. And keep in mind, everyone makes mistakes on plays. That's just the reality of it. We're just trying to minimize the number of mistakes that we make by simply trying to change your mindset just a little bit. Okay. I want a referee outcome. Okay. How did the play end? All right. So I think that may be the best bit of advice I can give you. And again, we're talking about a game where they're playing for you. You know, they're both ends, they're playing, they're competing. They know how to handle themselves, because if you get into a game where that's not the case and you're just trying to struggle to keep, you know, everything under control, things are a little bit different. But if you got a game that's competitive, you know, give them a chance to compete, give them a chance to make plays. I think that'll make you feel better about your performance. And I think it'll help the game too.
Thank you for sharing that. I wanted to share with you something that Crown Refs recently put out. You know, we have a Discord. We have an app called Discord where we communicate and share plays and discussions. And we have a camps channel. It's devoted just to camp information. And, you know, we were getting so many postings about camps, we decided to put together a national camp list. So I know you've been in the industry a while. There's really only one other site, phillyref.com, that has done something like this. Yeah. But we put together this cumulative list of over 135 different camps. I think we're up to 135 now. You know, and big shout out to Cameron from Virginia. He organized it beautifully, putting the states, the directors, the dates, the price, and the leagues. So just wanted to show you this. What do you think of this list?
That's awesome. You know what's really neat about this, and what this really indicates, it indicates the growth and the professionalism of what we do. I'll tell you, when I first, you know, started to think about camps, I didn't even think about camps, to be honest with you. I was refereeing, I think it was like 1987. I'm refereeing one of my first state tournaments in Colorado, and I'm refereeing to small schools. And the guy that was there evaluating it, sat down with me after my game, and he said, "You know, you do a pretty good job." He goes, "You have no idea what the hell you're doing, but you do a pretty good job." And he was right, to be honest with you. I refereed like, you know, someone that just understood the game, and, you know, I really wasn't trained. And he said, "You need to go to a camp." I didn't know what a camp was. And there were only like four camps in the country, literally. And he said, "You need to go to this camp." And I went to it. It was down in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And it was done by, you know,
Carmela. Carmela, were you at that camp?
Wait, Carmela,
which camp was it? Not as old as I am. Not even close.
It was in Albuquerque in 97. Were you there?
No, oh, 87.
I was 87. Okay, I wasn't born yet. I was born 3 years later.
I was born. Golly. You know how to hurt a guy. Man, oh man. But you know, you look at this, and you look at that list that you guys have put together, and it's, you know, it's incredible growth, and it's incredible the level of expectation that we have. You know, that's really cool. I mean, I know that there's a whole lot of stuff, a whole lot of schools moving from conference to conference, especially in my part of the world. And there's a whole lot of, you know, officials that are kind of looking over their shoulder and wondering, okay, what do I do? And of course, there's a lot of these opportunities that, you know, that you have all over the country. There's a couple here in Denver that I usually go and spend a little time at, and wow, I just looking at that list is crazy, you know.
Thank you. It's nice to be part of the growth, and everybody, oh, yeah. You know, who was in Crown Refs helped contribute to that list. So,
well, I mean, the other thing is, you know, this the whole thing that you do here, just the discussions, because you know. I'm a big believer in just, you know, listening to everyone. I already know what I think, you know, and there's reasons why I do, you know, my philosophy is what it is, or that's why I think this, or, but I want to know what other people think, because I don't know what they think. And there's so many times, that's the one thing that I did really well when I was first officiating. I listened to everyone. You know, and I mean intently listen to it, and I evaluated what they said, and some of it worked for me, and some of it I looked at and I said, that's a bunch of shit, excuse me, but that's what it was. Okay. But the rest of it, there were things that helped me become a better official just by one comment from some guy. And I'm not talking a Final Four guy, I'm talking about, you know, a guy that's refereeing high school games, you know, the whole, you know, admit mistakes thing. I remember getting that when I was refereeing my first couple years in high school. You know, everyone makes mistakes, admit them, move on, you know, that kind of thing. And that's an important lesson. And that's hard for some people. That's hard. I mean, really hard for some people. Some guys I work with, they make a mistake early. Man, oh man, you got 10 minutes of basketball to referee before that guy gets back engaged. Because, you know, it just, that's the influence that has on that particular guy, you know. But I think it's really important that you consider all sources. And I mean all sources, you know. And that's the beauty of this, you know. Everyone, I think, is with their feelings and thoughts and ideas, brings up a conversation and makes you think, which is really important.
Does anybody on the call have a question for Mr. Randy McCall while we have him? Feel free to unmute and ask or put it through the chat. Or, Randy, you can always just randomly ask somebody on the call because I know you wanted to hear from them. So feel free to prompt someone.
Well, I don't know. This kind of goes out to everyone. What's your why? What's your goal? I want to hear a few other ones. That's probably the best question we had today, because that's the core of what we do, and that's the core of how we perform. So I want to hear from some of you guys.
We'll let him think about that for a second while Tyler Gann has his hand raised. Tyler, I'm calling on you, sir. You can put your hand
down. Great. Thanks, Paul. Hey, Mr. Randy, appreciate you coming on and sharing some wisdom with us. One of my struggles that I feel like, and we had a lot of great points kind of leaning towards it, but with this camp list that we've collaborated and made of over 100 something camps, and sometimes can just seem to be overwhelming in trying to find and pick a spot of where to go and how to grow best. So I was going to say, can you attune kind of towards, not that any camp is as good as any camp, but really, you know, how to dial in a little bit further to get to a place to where that'll benefit the most, I guess. Yeah. I should say.
Yeah, I think that's a great point and a great question. I think everyone has to evaluate themselves and understand what their age and stage is and what's the next step in their career, their officiating career, and understand that. Some of these that are there, I recognize some names that are running the camps. Some of those camps are very much tryout camps. They're camps where people are trying to get, in employment. They're trying to get an opportunity to go referee Division I basketball. Let's say you're a high school official and this is your first camp. That's probably not a camp for you, because the goal of that camp, from the perspective of the people that are running the camp, isn't necessarily to teach a whole lot of, you know, rudimentary stuff. It's to find out who can referee and who they want to hire. Okay. So I think it's important that you evaluate yourself and place yourself in the proper camp, the camp that fits your level, the camp that can benefit you. Now, let's say that you've been in all these different camps that are training specific camps, and now you're ready to move forward and put yourself out there and say, listen, I think I deserve an opportunity to referee Division I basketball. This is a great opportunity for you to do that. But again, the person that's going to have to evaluate that is you. You've got to make that decision. And don't necessarily have to make that decision on your own. Everyone should have a mentor. Everyone should have someone that they can go to and they will truly trust that can tell them, hey, this probably is the best camp for you. This is kind of where you're at. When I first went to the camp, it was a teaching camp, period. Period. And I learned more in a week's worth of camp than I did in the first 5 years that I refereed. Kind of back to the comment that the guy made to me about, you know, you're pretty good, but I don't think you have any idea what you're doing. And he was right, you know, and I had to learn an awful lot. But that's probably the most important thing. Understand your age and stage. Understand where you should be, and pick a camp that you can gain from, okay, that you're going to have a positive outcome from. And that may not, it's not necessarily a camp that's going to put you in a Division One, on a Division One floor, you know. Does that all make sense? I think that's really important.
Sure does. Yes, sir. I appreciate
it. Sure.
Let's stay in Texas because we have a lot of members from Texas. Sean Collenberg, you had a question.
Yeah. So I loved your talk about keeping things positive and making sure that you don't pull down your crew with negativity. What are your personal strategies to maintaining your level-headedness when you get into a tough situation, or you've kicked a call, or you said something you wish you hadn't said? What is your strategy to keep your head level and make sure you're ready for the next play?
It's a great question because it happens a lot. I think the first thing is you own it. Whatever it is, you own it. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've said to a coach, I put a whistle and the guy is shooting free throws on a whistle that's really awful. And I'm standing over there next to him. And I just flat out say, coach, that might be the worst call of my career. Not of this year, but my career. You know, I mean, I'm just telling him this awful. That whistle, I can't defend that whistle in any way. And you'll be surprised how, number one, how they'll take it. They'll look at you like, you know, kind of like, what are they going to say to that? That's the worst. I mean, I just look at him and say, that's the worst call I've ever had, ever, ever. Or, you know what, coach, that one's bad. Sorry. It's mine. Screw up. What's he going to say? he might have a couple of things, then he'll move on. Because I've already said, Jesus Christ, I screwed up. And I think that's the first thing. Just you own it. You acknowledge that it screwed up. You probably know why in the moment, why you made that mistake. And then you just move on. But if you spend a lot of time trying to defend it or, you know, kind of work around it, you're worrying about what other people are thinking and what your partners are thinking. And you just, you know, if you own it and verbalize it and move on, it becomes a little bit simpler. I don't know. That makes sense. It's hard to do. It's really hard to do. But after you screw them up as many times as I have, it gets a little bit easier.
That's great. Thanks.
Yeah, that's when I realized there's a whole emotional component to officiating when you start making incorrect calls and having to, you know, mentally move on after that. That's a whole education within itself and a huge right. part of the game and what separates good officials from great officials. So,
well, and the other part is, you know, Paul, you have to understand yourself, you know, and you have to give yourself a break. We're our own worst critic in most cases. The really good referees are their own worst critic. And you have to give yourself a break. You have to understand, you know, Jesus Christ, you're pretty good, but you're not bulletproof. And that's something that I think is really important. Understand yourself, understand what your strengths are and understand, you know, what your value really is.
Being your biggest critic, but also maintaining that positive self-talk and not just mm-hmm. destroying yourself, you know, mm-hmm. to yourself, because you gotta uplift yourself. Even times during mistakes, you gotta find the positives to take with you. And just, you know, we beat ourselves up way too much. I think many people, both officials, non-officials, we're just, when we make a mistake, we're beating ourselves up. We're saying bad things about ourselves, and I don't find it productive. So finding that balance with how you evaluate yourself is huge too.
Yeah.
Another topic here, we had Jason Williams, White Chocolate. We had White Chocolate on. We had Jason Phillips. I wish I had White Chocolate on. Jason Phillips, a retired NBA official, recently spoke about the best way to discuss your partner's call. Especially, you know, newer officials, or you're working with somebody you've never worked with, how and when to insert yourself. Do you talk about your partner's call? When's the best place to do it? And he just mentioned starting with your own plays as a great, great icebreaker. What's your advice to the officials listening on how and when and the right way to discuss your partner's call?
Well, it's, I think by, you know, by discussing, by opening yourself up to say, God, you know, whatever mistake you may have made or perceived to have made, that's a great way to segue into it. A big part of it has to do with what's your relationship with that official, that other official, you know, but it's the hardest thing to do to sit down and talk with officials about mistakes they may have made or you perceive that they've made. I know that one of the guys I work for, his go-to is always, hey, what did you see on that play? You know, that's always, and whenever he says that to me, that's an indication that you screwed it up. You know, and to be real honest, I can almost say that every time he said that to me and started to segue into, you know, let's talk about that play, I knew I screwed it up, or I knew that, I don't know if I got that right or not. And that was, you know, I think everyone, anytime that you want to have a discussion with a partner about a play that they have that they may have missed, they're going to have an evaluation of it first and foremost. And for the most part, they're going to know that at best, it's going to be, I don't know if I got it right kind of thing. Okay. And to be able to simply, you know, ask them, you know, what did you see on that play? What were you thinking on that play? Well, I go back to the, you know, we talked about the calls at the basket where we have a block shot or a foul, or is it a body or is it not a body, you know, kind of thing. And we talked about, you know, point of contact and what it should have been. And sometimes there, you know, time and score become part of our profession. We don't admit it, but it does. You know, if I may take a play that's an iffy play and put a foul on it because the team that's going to go to the line is getting beat by 25, you know, there may be, that may be why I did that. Or there may just be, you know, the idea that shit, I just didn't get myself in a good spot. It looked like a foul and, you know, and I may not like it on film. You know, I think if you know people are comfortable talking about, you know, talking about themselves and the negativity sometimes that takes place, it's hard to get into an evaluation of a call without being negative. Okay, so if you can balance those two things, you know, talking about a call that's maybe questionable, and at the same time stay positive about it. And, you know, what did we see on that? What made us go to that? You know, and being able to say, to self-deprecate and say, I did the same damn thing last night. You know, I think sometimes that eases the ability to get yourself to talk about that that negative play. Because if you come out and say, what the hell were you looking at, man? That's not going to work. You know, it doesn't help at all. And you know what? I'm around guys that'll say that to you, but they know me really well. And they say that to me. Yeah, I don't know what the hell I was looking at. You know, we can have that discussion. So again, I go back to, what's your relationship with that fellow official? But it's a hard topic. It's a hard thing to do.
Your viewpoint on this might have changed over the years, but right now, looking back at your career, what do you think the hardest part of being an official is for you?
That's a great question. As I look back on it, the hardest part for me was being away. I watched my kids grow up from far. I missed a lot of things that, you know, maybe a dad shouldn't miss. You know, and that doesn't go away. I gotta be honest. I every time that I've gone out to referee, man, it's exciting. You know, I get jacked up to go referee. I don't care who's playing. It's been, you know, really a thrill, lack of a better term. It's been a thrill to go do the things and see the things that I've been able to see. And, you know, I mentioned being away from my family, being difficult, but at the same time, they've seen a number of things that they probably never would have seen either. But I can tell you, every time, you know, even in the middle of, let's say, you know, the first part of February, where we've been at it for three and a half months, and you can see the end in the scope of things, and, you know, it gets to be a grind. Yeah, it gets to be a grind, but you know what? I love that grind. I really do. And I love being on the court and having, you know, play the national anthem. It means something, man. It means that something exciting is going to happen. It's going to be fun. It's going to be a challenge. I can tell also that, you know, I'll tell you this. I live 40 minutes north of the Air Force Academy, and I've refereed a number of games there. And I can tell you every time that they play the Star Spangled Banner there, the national anthem there, you look at those kids, that song means something a little bit more to those guys than it does to most everyone else. Guarantee it. And just walking in that place, and it's not like they've got a, you know, it's a big basketball factory by any means. They don't fill the place and like that. But I tell you what, I love going there. I love going there because of what it means. And I love going there because those kids compete their ass off. You know, there are some hard things about it. I think being away is the top one. But, man, I wouldn't trade it. I refereed, coming up is going to be my 33rd year refereeing Division I basketball. And I've thoroughly enjoyed every moment, even the ones that left me, you know, unable to sleep that night, kind of thing. Yeah, I've enjoyed this shit. I wouldn't get to do any of this. I mean, seriously, I'm talking with people that challenge, you know, the way you think and bring up topics that are really important for us to talk about. And, you know, I'm sitting here like I have all the answers. Shit, I don't even know some of the questions, you know. And this has been, you know, what a great experience, you know, every bit of it. And if, when it gets to be something that's not a great experience, then it's time for me to move on.
And you broke the podcast curse record as well.
You should have told me. You should have told me that. You know what? Here's what we stand for. Then I still would have cussed. Okay, that's all right.
No, I don't care. It was a couple of harmless S bombs. We're good. I won't edit it. You're good.
All right.
I like putting punch sounds behind it though. That's fun.
Yeah, do that. Do that.
Kung fu sounds.
I can tell you this. If I speak again, I will be more aware of that.
So. No worries. I'm just messing with you. You got time for one more? Maybe you could fill us in on a little bit of your pregame, what that might sound like. I know we have officials working all levels, NCAA women's, mm-hmm. you know, high school. So without getting into a rule-specific pregame, just give us some universal thoughts on what you say to the crew before a game.
I start out with – typically, I start out with this, and I'm a pretty simple guy. I want to keep things simple because I think the more complicated we make this, the more difficult it is for us. Okay, I believe in us doing really simple things and doing them really, really well. Okay, I talk about the lead rotating and. Why I want, you know, the lead needs to rotate when we have a competitive post matchup along with a competitive perimeter matchup with the ball. We need to be there. Other than that, you know, lead referee the way you need to referee. I put a premium on refereeing your part of the play. In other words, you know, we have different areas that we're responsible for. Well, sometimes in those different areas, there's not anything going on. Okay, well, what do you do with that? Well, you extend your vision and try to find a hot spot that you can help referee. But the fact of the matter is, if all three of us referee our area and do it appropriately, we're not going to have a whole lot of trouble because there's going to be plays, for the most part, the plays that we start with are plays that everyone watching on television or everyone in the stands looks at and says, well, that's a foul. Yeah, that's a foul. Well, that's a foul. That's a foul. Everyone knows it's a foul. Okay. We have to get all of those plays. Every one of those plays have to be routine on the floor, just like they're routine with someone watching it, you know, at home on TV. That's a foul. That's a foul. We have to be like-minded in that regard. And the only way that we can do those, you know, get all of those plays is if we're all refereeing what we're supposed to referee. So let's just keep it simple there. Now, the league dictates what we're probably going to look at simply by whether they rotate or not. Okay. Two plays, I think all three referees have to referee it. Play to the basket, guys driving to the basket, you watch film, nothing else is going on other than that guy going to the basket. There's nothing going on in the perimeter. So if you've got someone on your crew say, well, I wasn't refereeing that because I was refereeing this guy, you know, he was in my area. Well, he was in your area and there was no one defending him. Okay, so that doesn't help us. If the ball goes to the basket, everyone's got to jump on board. Okay. Primary defender, you know, maybe it's the lead's responsibility. We discuss that, what the lead's responsibility is, what the center, if it's coming from their area, what their responsibility is, what's the trail responsibility, okay? Everyone's got to help refereeing that play to the basket. Number two, the second play that everyone's got to help referee is rebounding. Once the shot goes up, everyone's got to referee their competitive matchup and rebound. Okay. I'm a really good rebounding referee. If I just have my two guys right here, I'm going to referee this competitive matchup. I'll take that because if I'm the lead and that strong side rebound, I'll take care of that. Okay. I'm trusting that my center is going to referee the weak side rebound. Okay. So if we all do that and we trust each other to do what they're supposed to do, to referee their part of the play appropriately, and everyone participate in refereeing those two plays, plays to the basket and rebounding, we're going to have a pretty good night. As long as we're like-minded when it comes to plays that demand some higher level of judgment, if that makes sense. You know, let's start with the easy stuff. Let's make sure that all those plays that are just fouls, we call them. Now we get into plays where it's, you know, the block shot. Is it point of contact? Is it a block shot? Is it, you know, is it a foul with the body? Those types of things. Do we make sure that when we have a no call at this end, we go to the other end of the floor and we're like-minded enough to have this a similar play and it's a no call at that end of the floor too? Because then all of a sudden, the game starts to look the same from one end to the other, okay? Those are kind of the things that we talk about when I have a pregame. And it's not just me talking. It's okay, what's on your mind, guys? What's going on? What happened in your last game? You know, kind of getting everyone on the same page, you know? Hopefully going out there with the same thought process. You know, we talk about the teams. I think it's important to talk about the teams. We talk about the personalities. We talk about who's important for us to try to keep in the game. We talk about the coaches. You know, sometimes it's really good. Hey, this guy's a good guy. If he says something, there's probably something there, you know, that kind of thing. You know, I don't know. I know there over my career, there's been all kinds of people that have done all kinds of different things in terms of pregames. And again, from my perspective, we got to make this as simple as we can. If we make it simple, we make it doable, we make it something that we collectively can do together, that's a huge step forward. So
appreciate you sharing those nuggets. You know, there's been a couple times, not many, but a couple times I was doing a podcast with somebody or, you know, I'm just looking at the clock and saying, all right, I got to drag this out a little bit, make sure we hit the proper amount of time. This episode, I'm doing the opposite. I'm saying, oh man, we need at least another hour. So this has been really fun. Just breaking down these various topics with you and appreciate your contributions to the podcast. Is there anything you'd like to say in closing to the dedicated audience of officials listening?
No, I probably talk too much, but this is something that's really important to me. It's become, it's become a huge part of, you know, my life. And it's something that, you know, I'm at the point now where I'm starting to think, okay, you know, what am I going to leave behind? And stuff like this, you know, having people that want to, you know, collaborate to think about things, because I hope what everyone walks away from here isn't just, you know, all the answers. I don't have all the answers. I can pose a lot of questions, and I want you guys to think about how it applies to you, how it applies to your next game, how it applies to this crew, you know, what can we do to make this crew tonight be good enough to get the game right? Because you know what, everyone's into game grading and stuff like that. It's great, fine. I can tell you this, the first person that knows when he misses a call in my game, it's me. When I screw up something, I screwed it up. Yeah. Why'd I screw it up? I have to think about that. There's a number of different things. But if we simply collaborate well enough to say, hey, we got the game right, we got this game right, you know, we don't want to screw up a play in the last 2 minutes. I know the NBA has the 2 minute report, whatever it is, you know, in my game, they talk about the last 4 minutes. Okay. But if we screw something up there that maybe has an impact on the outcome of the game, that eats at you. Okay. But if we get the game right, you know, I have, you know, supervisors, how to go, got the game right. Hard game. We missed a few, but got the game right. You know, that's all that matters to me. Can we get the game right? And collectively, all the people that are here, you know, can you go out and take a different crew and get this game right, whatever game it may be? I think that's really important for us to do. And this is a huge step, you know, in kind of doing that, because it poses questions and it makes you think. I've had to think, yeah, that's one of the greatest things in the world. My wife would never believe that. I'm thinking, but I'll try to tell her that.
You hear that, Lori?
Yeah. You can tell who's in charge in my house. Christ.
She runs all the technology, all the devices.
Everything. My wife's a corporate attorney. She's the smartest person I know. And it's infuriating because I can't win an argument even when I'm right. So I just don't argue. It's kind of like trying to talk to a coach that just is a knucklehead. It's not worth talking to him.
Well, once again, we thank you for your time and appreciate all the wisdom you shared. And hopefully we could do it again in the future. And we'll be rooting for you as we watch you work in the future. So
appreciate it.
Thank you again.
Thank you. Appreciate it, guys.
Thank you for listening to the Crown Refs Podcast. Serve the game.
Right, Johnny Gleish reaching out. We're going knee tucks. Comfortable feel, you know, easy to put on in the locker room before a game. I'll hang my shirt up, put them on the shirt. Once you pop your shirt on, after you're done with stretching and warming up, you know, they clip real quick. You can have a little slide band to tighten them up and down. I like to go tight, just like a sneaker. When you lace your shoes up, you like it tight. It's going to loosen up after the game goes, as you run, as your muscles flex. And they never ride up. Some, you know, I've had good success with these, keeping my shirt in. When you're at the free throw line, watching the game, you don't want to be messing with your pants. Knee tucks are, you know, the way that helps us to not do that.